If something like this can happen in a country like New Zealand, I don't see how anyone can feel safe anywhere.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And today we reflect on a day of horror in New Zealand, the country's first mass shooting in nearly 30 years.
That is the city where I was born. That is the city where I became who I am. You know, my formidable years were there, and I just feel so violated.
Lamia Imam was at home in Austin, Texas, when she found out about an attack at her hometown mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand.
The mosque where the majority of the people died, that was the first mosque I ever went to as a baby.
Imam's family left New Zealand for several years, but she returned as a teenager.
I went to university in Christchurch, and it's a very peaceful, almost has a small town vibe to it.
That peace was shattered when a terrorist entered Al Noor Mosque on Friday and shot and killed 42 people before driving to another mosque 3 miles away and killing 8 more.
I saw it as breaking news when there was no information. And when I first saw it, I really kind of dismissed it because I did not think that something like this would ever happen in New Zealand. I was in such shock. I couldn't believe that that could even be true.
The carnage didn't square with Imam's memories of the mosque as a place that peacefully brought together people from so many backgrounds, where the sounds of English mix with Hindi and Arabic. Imam says she's grateful that the people she knows in New Zealand are safe, but the attack on her community feels deeply personal.
It's one of those things where even if it's not your family or somebody you know, the community is so small. And if you've been to a place and see something like this happen, it feels like they are your family in a weird way. So some of the images that I was looking at, it's so heart-wrenching because even if it's faces I don't know, there are faces I would know, if that makes any sense. And so it still feels like it's your family.
Imam, who works at a tech company now, says the attack doesn't fit with her understanding of New Zealand.
You know, people don't really have guns. People don't talk about guns in New Zealand like the way they talk about it in America, because here in Texas, there's been towns here where armed hate groups have shown up to mosques, right, to intimidate people. And I have not gone to a mosque here in Texas since I've moved here. I would not go because I know people in Texas carry guns. I know that people open carry, and I know people conceal carry, and I'm terrified.
The attack has left her feeling that there's no place where she can practice her faith in peace.
It's so unexpected and so horrific because it just makes no sense and it makes you feel so unsafe. One of the things that I always think about living here in the U.S. is sometimes the violence that you see in the news makes you feel, hey, I could just leave and go back home and go back to New Zealand where it's safe, where nothing like this ever happens, where a country that's far, far away in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And then when you see a news like that, you realize there is really no safe place left. When leaders say things that fuel hatred in somewhere like the US or the UK or Europe, it's not just constrained to those places. People hear them everywhere.
Lamia Imam says she hopes to see stricter gun laws in New Zealand, and that looks like it will happen. But in the meantime, her heart is in her home country.
New Zealand is a really tiny country. We're a country of 4.5 million people, and people are really, really grieving and really sad. So I just want to say that I'm grieving with them.
Lamia Imam is a longtime member of the Al Noor Mosque in Christchurch, and she lives in Texas. Fifty people were killed in Friday's shooting in Christchurch, New Zealand, at two mosques. The victims range from 3-year-old Muka Abdi to 71-year-old grandfather Dawood Nabi. All of them were Muslim. Their deaths are part of an alarming pattern of white supremacist violence around the world, including here in the United States. Kathleen Ballou is assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. She's also the author of the book Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Kathleen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned at the top, we're seeing this attack fit into other patterns of attacks we've seen in recent years, including here in the United States. I think Charlottesville, I think of Pittsburgh. How is it that this white supremacist violence is unfolding the way it is today?
Well, let's start out by thinking a little bit about our terminology. I think that We want to use a phrase to name this movement that is specific and concrete and that conveys the radical nature of the future imagined by these activists. And for that reason, I think we should think of this not as white supremacist or white nationalist violence, but as a coordinated social movement, the white power movement. And the reason I say that is that when we talk about nationalist violence, most people, I think about the nation as being the center of that term and assume that the nation means the United States. But for this group of people, and as we saw so clearly in the attacks in New Zealand, the nation imagined here is not the United States or New Zealand or Australia, where the gunman seems to be from, but rather this idea of a transnational Aryan nation, a white nation that is bounded together in common purpose. So what we see is the emergence of a transnational understanding that links different white countries together for these activists and creates kind of a world map of violent possibility.
I want to get into a little bit more of the specifics there. We're also now joined by Khalid Beydoun, who's an associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Khalid.
Thanks for having me.
So you have been tweeting about each of the victims since this attack happened, and you've also been receiving messages from family members and friends and victims of the attack. Why did you choose that approach? Why is it important to highlight each of these victims individually?
Well, I think what prompted me to keep a thread of the 50 victims was, you know, first I was doing media and I realized that there was a lot of fixation on the terrorist, his manifesto, his white populist vision, and no attention being paid to the individuals on the ground who were slaughtered by the terrorists. So being Muslim American myself and, you know, hearing a lot of frustration from members of my community, my family members, you know, I took it upon myself to try to give face, humanize the stories of the 50 individuals, to portray them, you know, more than just statistics or, you know, numbers that were rising, as more about the massacre was being learned, to try to convey the idea that these were real people with real families and real stories.
Another thing that we're seeing, Khalid, to Kathleen's point earlier, is this white power movement that's growing across the world. This attack, I'm wondering if you can tell us also a little bit about how this squares with the rise of Islamophobic violence specifically.
Yeah, so when I think of white supremacy or white populism, it's really critical to not think about it as, you know, a fringe movement, something that is aberrant or deviant. It's mainstream. It has a rich history. There's an underbelly that's rising to the fore. You have politicians, whether it be Donald Trump or this individual in Australia, Fraser Anning, who echoed the idea that it was immigration, right? It was Muslims that were the cause of the massacre. So you have this relationship, this bind, if you will, between the vigilante terrorists on the ground and the politicians who are feeding them with the rhetoric and the ideas that emboldens the kind of violence we see in New Zealand. And, you know, part of the white populist vision, obviously, is centered on anti-Muslim bigotry. They view Muslims as a rival civilization, a rival political ideology. And individuals like the terrorists on the ground in New Zealand feel as if, and they write in the manifesto, that they're launching a crusade against Muslims. So Islamophobia is central to this white supremacist, white populist vision.
Kathleen, I want to bring you in here. At the top of the show, we heard from Lamia Imam, who's a woman who lives here in the United States but attended this mosque. And one of the things that she said that was so powerful, and I'm quoting here, is that she says, when you're in a country that's far, far away in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and she basically says there's really no safe space left. And I'm wondering, she also mentions that when leaders say things that fuel hatred somewhere like the U.S. or the U.K. or Europe, that hatred, if you will, is not constrained to those places. Kathleen, can you help us understand a little bit about the influence that rhetoric, like what was cited by this terrorist of the president of the United States, how that impacts what we're seeing today?
Well, let me say this. I think that this is one place where history can really help us to understand what is happening. And one of the things that stood out to me and what the first person was saying was the phrase, it just makes no sense. And that's a common response to attacks like this. And it's completely understandable, especially for people who have deep ties to community like that. And I have to commend the work that my fellow panelist is doing in humanizing and bearing witness to this violence. But the thing that history can do here is precisely to help us make sense of what it is and what it means. And I actually think we want to be very, very cautious in sort of painting with the same brush political rhetoric that is doing some of the same symbolic work that we see in something like this Shooter's Manifesto and the on-the-ground acts of violence carried out by white power activists, which is a bounded and much more concrete sphere of this kind of ideology.
Can you give I was going to say, if you can tease that out a little bit,
yeah,
because
sure.
I think when we hear, you know, particularly when we hear and see the connections between this current administration and white supremacists and white power movement in the United States, it's hard not to make the link to what's happening abroad.
You're right. And I think we should be making that link. And I think there's a big conversation we need to have about the many ways that this kind of violence is enabled and given both tacit and direct acceptance by people in power and by institutions and by different spheres of our society. I think that that is very, very important. But let me say this. The last time that this movement turned to a wave of intense revolutionary violence in the 1980s, it was not under an administration that sought to contain it, but was rather under the second term of the Reagan administration. And having someone in power that activists on the fringe might have been assumed to see was sort of a compatriot in some ways, or at least they stood to benefit from the policies of the Reagan administration in some really concrete and material ways, that didn't contain this violence. And in fact, the activists on the fringe saw what they thought of as the comparative moderation of Reagan compared to the kinds of things that they wanted to do as a sort of a reason to declare race war. So what happens is sometimes when society as a whole sees politicians backing up this kind of violence with rhetoric or seeming to condone it, they think, aha, these fringe groups are going to be happy with this kind of an answer, and therefore we're going to see a decrease in violence, when in fact the opposite has been true historically.
Khalid, I want to ask you something we heard in the opening segment. Lamia Imam says there doesn't seem to be any safe space left. How do the politics of recent decades influence how people are feeling today, particularly Muslims who are looking for a safe space to live and pray?
So beyond the discourse, beyond the rhetoric from politicians, which might embolden violence, we have policy, right? So it's critical to understand that in this country, we have a standing Muslim ban. Right, so there's laws in place that demonize Muslims as being this enemy invader that we want to keep beyond our borders. And before the Muslim ban, we obviously had this protracted war on terror. It was built upon programs like government surveillance within mosques. So even though we think about religious spaces like mosques or synagogues or churches as being these purified places where individuals should expect safety, the fact that the state has penetrated these spaces, specifically mosques, in a very extreme way, and effectively branded them as spaces where individuals become terrorists and become radicalized, is signaling to private individuals, private terrorists, that you got to keep tabs on these mosques. You got to keep tabs on these individuals praying within these spaces, which then facilitates the possibility of something like a massacre that we saw in Christchurch taking place. So there's a direct connection between rhetoric, but there's also a nexus between policy that enables this kind of thing to happen.
Kathleen, I want to bring you back in because we were talking before the break a little bit about the history behind some of these movements. What about players like, for example, Steve Bannon, who has sort of, left the American military, the American political stage for the time being, if you will, and sort of taken off to Europe and beyond? Do folks like that have a direct influence on what we're seeing, or are those two separate schools of thought and ideology?
Well, I'm a historian, and I don't study the current moment in that way, but I think that the history here is very, very instructive. And from the beginning, this is a movement that has been transnational in character. And like most transnational phenomena, that means it's influenced both by inflows from other places. And we could look at, for instance, the influx of skinhead culture from Great Britain that gets instrumentalized and becomes a racist force in the United States in the late 1980s, and also direct exports efforts to other places via the internet, but also via, Aryan Nations sent literature and publications to different places in the 1980s and 1990s. Groups like World Church of the Creator and Wotansvolk created chapters in different countries. So an activist in Australia would have been accessing this information and culture not only through websites, but also through reprinted newspapers, sending away for materials, listening to radio sermons, and also creating relationships with other activists. This is a social movement that's always been transnational in form and has decades and decades of experience in organizing.
And Khalid, I want to bring you in here because what impact does that have? I'm still struck with the phrase that there is no safe space. And I think a lot of us feel that way in our homes, in our countries, so whoever those of us who are marginalized. So what can the community do, or what has the response been, if anything, to this increase in white power violence?
Well, I think part of the strategy of whether it be Trump, whether it be, these terrorists on the ground, is to intimidate Muslims from freely exercising their religion, from conspicuously expressing their Muslim identity, from being Muslim, right? They want people like my mom to rethink about her wearing the hijab when she steps out of the house. They want people like my two nieces who are college students to reconsider being part of the MSA, the Muslim Student Association, and to wear the hijab. That's kind of the long game, right? That's the long game of these terrorists. And to be frank with you, I think it's the long game of the Steve Bannons of the world I think it's critical to think about him as a bridge with what's taking place on the ground with white supremacists and trying to mainstream that movement to make it palatable, politically speaking, and to make it palatable to young people. And I think we see, you might want to call it an evolution of white supremacy, and I'm not an expert on this stuff, but if you look at what happened in Charlottesville, right, they're cleaning up the way they look. They look like, J. Crew sort of models on a magazine of some kind, right? So there's an aspiration and objective of white supremacists to move away from that skinhead sort of archetype into looking like your neighbors so they can become more palatable to the political mainstream.
Khalid Baydoun is associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, and Kathleen Ballou is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Thanks, Kathleen, and thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway also got reaction to the terrorist attack from Paul Spoonley, a sociologist at Massey University in New Zealand.
Even though I've been doing research on the extreme right in New Zealand for almost four decades, the events of recent days when a ultra-right shooter entered two Christchurch mosques and shot the worshippers have been deeply unsettling. I've warned often of the potential violence of these groups, but to see it being realised is truly unsettling. And like all New Zealanders, we are having to rethink who we are and what defines us. It's a deeply unsettling moment in our country's history.
Spoonley says he's been warning the New Zealand government about the far right in the country for a long time. We also heard from Muhammad Nabil Musharraf of the Islamic Circle of Australia and New Zealand. He's based in Australia.
The whole community is in shock after this incident. New Zealand is a very peaceful country. Its people are very friendly and welcoming. So no one was expecting such brutality to have happened here. This has caused great trauma for the entire community. 49 families, at least, won't see their loved ones again. There are many others who are still in hospitals in critical condition. So it is indeed a moment of great tragedy, unmatched tragedy, in the history of New Zealand. We are all extremely sad about that.
Musharraf told The Takeaway that his community won't let hate divide the society.
That is what the terrorists wanted, but we won't let that happen. We'll continue to be the contributing members of the broader communities that we live in. Nothing can hinder us from that. At the same time, we are trying to help the families of the victims. Some of the charity organizations have established funds, but none of this help can fill the vacuum that has been created because of the lowly terrorist acts. We need support in that regard. We need our governments and our media agencies and our news channels to play a role in that. We all have to act as one against hate and the hate mongering, which leads to such tragic incidents.
That was Muhammad Nabil Musharraf of the Islamic Circle of Australia and New Zealand. And you also heard from sociologist Paul Spoonley of Massey University in New Zealand. You're listening to The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.